a stable government, a creative population, a buoyant economy. But much like China's rise in the 21st century, America's also brought an air of skepticism. Few people knew the United States' intentions or how it would wield its growing power. Fairchild left Baghdad with arm muscles bulging under the weight of fully formed fruit. He might have found it easier to acquire suckers, the base offshoots of date trees, yet Fairchild knew suckers could die on a 9-week ocean voyage, so he decided to take both fruit and suckers, an insurance policy in hopes one would live. He spread mud on the deck of the boat that carried him away. The captain watched, bemused, while Fairchild laid down the suckers, doused them in water, and then rolled them through the mud. When the dirt dried hard as clay, he wrapped it all in sackcloth to retain the moisture. Because of either Fairchild's ingenuity or a simple stroke of luck, the suckers made the ocean voyage alive. In the years following shipments like Fairchild's, the date industry elevated the American West. Dates came to populate Southern California in a way no crop had before. By the 1910s, growers were taking the next step in agricultural innovation by selecting the dates that grew best in the microclimates of Southern California. One of those dates, the Deglet Nor, infused life and economic vitality into California's Coachella Valley by exploiting soil and climate nearly identical to the Arabian Peninsula's. The influence was so appreciated that in the 1930s, Coachella Valley High School named its mascot the Arab, not from cartoonish racism, but, officials argued, in honor of an agricultural gift as meaningful to Coachella as Lady Liberty had been to New York. The Indian Ocean, azure and clear with clashing calm, passed by without any remarkable thought from Fairchild. Despite the perception of global travel as the height of glamour, the actual demands of spending long voyages on boats and docking in cities full of diseases were beginning to show signs of wear on a man who had now circled the globe nearly 3 times. In his journal, in place of his earlier boyish fascination with discovering new things, he started to dwell on the hardships of travel. "The food was bad on the boat, and everyone was very tired of it," was all that he wrote on the ship from which he departed the Persian Gulf. He was not only wary of disease, but in the diversity of all he had seen, he had become sensitive to items of low quality and the distracting drama of people fighting. Because of his aversion to violence, he avoided Karachi, where he was told he would have needed a personal guard, and instead entrusted a few dozen dollars to 2 fellow travelers and asked them to send more date suckers to the United States. The travelers complied, but their naive efforts proved worthless when the plants, their roots cut too short, arrived dead. From India, he could have gone anywhere, but he moved quickly toward Japan. Barbara Lathrop was on an adventure of his own and had suggested they meet in Yokohama, near Tokyo, a destination requiring 28 days of transit. When his boat laid over in Saigon, then a French colony, Fairchild came across a French botanist as eager to introduce new plants to France's colonies as Fairchild was to bring them to America. Plant exploration had become more common, especially for countries with colonies to support with new crops. The Frenchman helped Fairchild find mangoes and mangosteens, 2 unrelated fruits. In all his travels, Fairchild would come to describe the mangosteen, with its purple rind and wedges of white flesh, as the queen of tropical fruits. It has a beautiful white fruit pulp, more delicate than that of a plum, and a flavor that is indescribably delicate and delicious. He speculated that its purple-brown rind will bring fancy prices wherever it is offered for sale. This prediction proved flat wrong when American farmers found the mangosteen's skin too thick, its flesh too small, and its shape too oblong to produce at large scale. That would be especially disappointing to Fairchild. For a man who had seen dozens of countries and thousands of fruits, he would go so far as to call the mangosteen his favorite. The port of Yokohama was strewn with small fishing boats and straw-hatted men, who all looked up at the sight of a steamer pulling to dock. Having spent a month on a boat, any passenger would burn with desperation to escape the rocking and rediscover his balance. Fairchild knew to stand at the gangplank to be the first to disembark the ship. The air was heavy with the odor of fish. As the passengers left the steamer, the boatsmen returned to their nets, alive with twitching silver. Fairchild made his way to Lathrop's hotel, as eager to see his friend as he was to hear English again after a month at sea.
"Don't move!" Lathrop shouted.
He was sitting up in bed, newspapers covering his lap. He had a cold, and doctors, fearing something serious, had ordered him to stay horizontal. With Fairchild frozen, Lathrop clutched a paper funnel and, with two fingers, tapped tiny brown shavings into a beer bottle.
"I had a hell of a time getting this seed, and since those fellows in Washington want it for breeding, I don't propose to lose it now," Lathrop said, still without looking up.
While Fairchild had been exploring India and Iraq, Lathrop had hunted tobacco in Southeast Asia, stopping in Singapore and Java. He chatted up local gardeners and farmers in hopes of finding the valuable Delhi strain of tobacco, which Northeast American farmers wanted as a replacement for their inferior varieties. He finally struck gold in Sumatra. Lathrop flattered Sumatran growers with lavish praise for their agricultural wisdom, from which America could learn. But when he eventually asked for seeds in a peaceful exchange between the two peoples, he was laughed out of the room. Rebuffed, he let loose with his usual candor about the stupidity of the tobacco growers. One grower saw opportunity in Lathrop's desperation, and later visited him with an offer to secretly sell him a small sample of seed at a steep price, more than $30. The wealthy Lathrop happily accepted, and the man sent the seed. In Lathrop's later retelling of the story, the man apparently died before receiving his payment, thus allowing Lathrop, in his own estimation, to emerge victorious.
"What kept you so long?" he asked Fairchild after the tobacco dust was packed. "You missed the Japanese flowering cherry trees. However, I suppose you got a lot of date palms. I would like to have seen Baghdad with you, but I knew you would collect more stuff if I were not along. Besides, I imagine the food was pretty bad, wasn't it? Anyway, I've missed you. I've been laid up in the hotel for a couple of weeks now. I'm in no shape to go around with you. You can do better work alone, anyhow."
Traces of the former senior-junior relationship had dissipated, as made clear by Lathrop's eagerness to see again the younger man with whom he could indulge the most bombastic and grandiose versions of himself, without fear of being ostracized or judged. Indeed, the reason that Fairchild had rushed to Japan without stopping for any additional exploration was to glimpse the Japanese flowering cherry trees. Lore of the trees was known all over East Asia, and some horticulturists in Washington knew of the tree's great springtime beauty. Fairchild wondered if the cherry trees, which didn't produce actual cherries but only pink blossoms, would be attractive to farmers. Probably not, was his conclusion, and so he sent only a few dozen cuttings to officials in California, who were so confused when the branches and roots turned up in 1903 that they neglected them in the broiling sun of California's Central Valley. Only years later would it dawn on Fairchild that the United States' East Coast would be best for flowering cherries, and specifically Washington, D.C. For most of the stay in Japan that summer, Lathrop was too worn out to explore, so Fairchild continued the type of solo adventuring that he enjoyed. Of all the countries Fairchild had visited, Japan struck him as the most advanced on matters of horticulture. He learned about Japanese miniature gardens, the art of Japanese papermaking, and the superior qualities of Japanese fruits and vegetables that didn't grow anywhere else in the world. Wealthy people introduced him to foods of affluence, like raw fish, seaweed, and a bean cheese they called tofu. He thought it impossible to eat with two narrow sticks held in one hand, but after a few tries, he got the feel for it. It was in Japan that Fairchild picked up a yellow plum known as a loquat and an asparagus-like vegetable called udo, and a so-called puckerless persimmon that turned sweet in sake wine casks. One of the most unrecognized discoveries of Fairchild, a man drawn to edible fruits and vegetables, was zoysia grass, a rich green lawn specimen attractive for the thickness of its blades and its slow growth, which meant it required infrequent cutting. And then there was wasabi, a plant growing along stream beds in the mountains near Osaka. It had edible leaves, but wasabi's stronger quality was its bitter root's uncanny ability to burn one's nose. Wasabi only lasted in America until farmers realized that its close relative, the horseradish root, grew faster and larger, and was more pungent than the delicate wasabi, which tends to stay pungent only 15 minutes after it's cut. Small American farms still grow Fairchild's wasabi, but most of the accompaniment to modern sushi is in fact horseradish, mashed, colored, and called something it's not. As weeks fell by, Fairchild found that he enjoyed the horticultural lessons Japan had to teach, not to mention the social discipline lacking in the hurried avenues of the United States. The quietest days of Fairchild's life were spent in bamboo gardens near Tokyo. One afternoon, in the late golden light, amid tall green stalks and the soft rustle of leaves in the wind, Fairchild took an hour, maybe even two, to sit silently and meditate. Chapter 13. Bell's Grand Plan. In August of 1903, upon his return to Washington, Fairchild's reputation preceded him, and he received an invitation to speak to the National Geographic Society. Fairchild had heard of the elite club that fancied itself the headquarters of well-traveled and adventurous men. He had offhandedly written a story in 1898 about his travels in Java for the Society's struggling journal. But to be invited into the lion's den, filled with the country's most learned, wealthy, and well-connected men, was an honor extended to few. The invitation came from Gilbert Grosvenor one evening in the parlor of the Cosmos Club. Grosvenor remarked that, considering all he had heard, he thought Fairchild would have a white beard. It was a polite way of saying Fairchild looked young. Grosvenor, with slick black hair parted on his left, wasn't old either, just 28, nor was he worldly. His job as editor of the National Geographic magazine had come from a series of nepotistic favors. Alexander Graham Bell, the famed inventor and one of the bearded men who unquestionably belonged in the Geographic's marbled meeting house, had gotten Grosvenor the job. Grosvenor had married Bell's daughter, Elsie, and not long after, Bell lobbied the Society's council to secure his new son-in-law a stable income. Grosvenor had no experience running a magazine, but he was given the keys to the publication with the imperative to build it, or at the very least, to keep it alive. Fairchild had a healthy ego by now, letting his head grow with his reputation as one of the most extensively traveled men in the world, according to a 1904 profile in the Houston Post. He spent evenings in all-male clubs, chiefly the Cosmos, which one historian later called the closest thing to a social headquarters for Washington's intellectual elite. He was regularly quoted in newspapers and fielded frequent questions as a horticultural authority. One reason for Fairchild's inflated confidence may have been his obliviousness about social Washington. Except for a few weeks of respite, Fairchild had been absent from the city nearly half a decade, during which Washington bloomed with the youthful energy of Teddy Roosevelt. Roosevelt approached governing with the same force he once brought to battle in Cuba, evading any attack thrown at him. He courted members of Congress on long horseback rides. He built a briefing room near his office to curry favor with journalists. He renamed the executive mansion the White House and got rid of its passé Victorian decor. Then he started to invite young people inside for dances and social events. Fairchild missed all of it and knew virtually no one. If the sage men of the National Geographic Society had wide renown, Fairchild knew almost nothing about them. That was especially true of Bell, the burly and whiskered Scottish-American inventor. Even in 1904, Alexander Graham Bell was a household name, the kind that made audiences applaud and cheer in appreciation for his magical creation that transmitted a human voice by electrical current. 3 decades after its invention, very few houses had a telephone, but everyone knew about it. Standing before a roomful of white beards and puffed mustaches, Fairchild hadn't the slightest idea what Bell looked like. Every man in the audience looked the same, so he tailored his speech to no one in particular. Fairchild delivered the pitch that he had by now refined over thousands of conversations. The government enterprise of planned introduction is to introduce and establish in America as many of the valuable crops of the world as can be grown here. It's to educate the farmer in their culture and the public in their use. To increase by this, one of the most powerful means, the agricultural wealth of the country. He detailed the greatest successes, the Japanese rice, the Corsican citron, the tropical mango. He explained how importing dates had created a new industry in California, with millions of dollars at stake. His presentation demonstrated the kind of political awareness that most men never find, the clairvoyance to understand when the government must invest before profit-driven companies can rush in and improve. Acquiring plants and producing food are problems that private enterprise will not naturally undertake. They are problems that concern the wealth-producing power of American soil. They are problems that the government has shown its ability to solve in a manner involving an insignificant outlay of the public funds. They encourage the production of food and other products that we now import from other lands, and they concern the establishment of farm industries which, for generations to come, will support hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions, of American citizens. When he finished, the men lined up to shake Fairchild's hand and tell him how their lives once intersected with the contents of his remarks. The line slowly grew shorter until, at the end, Rovner approached him with news that Bell had invited Fairchild to his weekly Wednesday gathering at his home in DuPont Circle. Wednesday evenings were shorthand for Bell's private salons, which some believed held more prestige than a visit to the White House. In the moments after he accepted the invitation, Fairchild had the impulse to buy a new suit and visit a barber. Fairchild's return to Washington was different this time, primarily in how it formed a punctuation mark at the end of his lengthy travels. He was tired and longed for consistency. He wanted to sleep in a bed where the horizon didn't shift. Almost penniless, he needed a regular salary. And at 34, he wondered whether he might spend less time searching for plants and more time finding a wife. Fairchild didn't cower when he visited Secretary Wilson. It was his third return to Washington, his third time unemployed. Wilson had so benefited from Fairchild's fearless and pro bono work on behalf of the department that he couldn't possibly refuse Fairchild's request for a job. But he did reveal his slight but still unquenchable resentment for Fairchild's unprofessional departure in 1898. When it was time to discuss Fairchild's salary, Wilson offered $1,000 per year, the equivalent of a paltry $50,000 today for a man of lofty education and worldly experience. Even less flattering, Wilson assigned Fairchild the cumbersome work of compiling an inventory of all plants imported into the United States since 1900. The Department of Agriculture had ballooned since the early days when Fairchild was a junior botanist. A few dozen employees had become 4,000. "This branch of our government had become one of the greatest research centers in the world," Fairchild noticed. The department had outgrown its offices so frequently that agriculture officials overflowed into the Treasury and state offices. At this pace, the Department of Agriculture's modest red brick headquarters would be demolished and replaced in the 1930s with a vast marble complex, sprawling in its reach and purpose, with more than 4,000 rooms. It was, at that time, the largest office building in the world. 4 months passed before Fairchild could arrange the scattered memos and mailing labels for the inventory, which together amounted to 4,396 introduced plants. In his introduction to the inventory, Fairchild thanked everyone who had contributed seeds, 11 people in all. Yet he also puffed his well-formed ego. He made clear that most items tallied had come from the writer of the document, himself. Meanwhile, the enduring feud between Wilson and Lathrop, now just embers from an earlier flame, still left Lathrop unpaid the full recognition he thought himself owed. Fairchild's new position provided him the full means to thank his benefactor himself. "Of the nearly 4,400 new introductions, a very large number represent work accomplished by the explorations of Mr. Barber Lathrop of Chicago, with whom I had the pleasure of being associated as agricultural explorer," Fairchild wrote in the report, a copy of which was sent to the president. "Mr. Lathrop's explorations, which have required about 4 years of travel abroad, were carried out with the one practical object of making a reconnaissance of the useful plant possibilities of the world, and have successfully covered every continent and touched every important archipelago." He called Lathrop a public-spirited man, further tipping the government's hat to Lathrop's philanthropy, and knowing how satisfying Lathrop would find it. The assertion of every continent made Fairchild especially proud. No one counted Antarctica. Barely had Ernest Shackleton even embarked south of the 82nd parallel. But the boast did include Africa. Despite having visited, Fairchild knew much remained on the vast continent to be explored. Egypt was a cosmopolitan meeting place, yet below the Sahara Desert, the land remained largely untouched, except by European colonists. Lathrop had urged Fairchild to visit Africa before settling down, not only because he believed it would have new plants, but because Lathrop was a man known to do things solely to brag about them later. So Fairchild's final trip, before he returned to Washington, before he spoke to the National Geographic Society, and before he met a woman who would captivate him, was, as he put it, to circumnavigate Africa. Visiting Africa was indeed boastworthy. Few Westerners went, most kept away by racist caricatures of uncivilized tribespeople. In 1898, the Royal Geographical Society had sent the British explorer Ewart Grogan to walk from Cape Town to Cairo, along the way exploring what he called the pygmies of uncontacted tribes. "This obviously entails a great risk," Grogan wrote. His widely published dispatches compared the tribal men to dog-faced baboons. Grogan, himself neither an anthropologist nor a biologist, showed little shame in questioning whether the savage people of Africa were in fact the missing link of Darwinism, the bridge between wild primates and modern humans. Fairchild avoided drawing this conclusion, which he would have found scientifically suspect, if not intuitively far-fetched, in part because he didn't venture too far inland. An ocean-based voyage wasn't the best way to discover a wide piece of land, but it did allow expedience and safety. "I was much disappointed, for I had hoped to find something worthwhile, and felt sure that there would be many things if we had time enough to get into the interior," Fairchild recalled. The coast was made even less remarkable by the fact that most shoreline had been colonized in Europe's power struggles between Britain, France, Germany, Italy, Belgium, Spain, and Portugal, which were really a fight over the continent's commodities, including palm oil, rubber, and cotton. The bickering over land had become so heated that in 1894 the German Chancellor Otto von Bismarck convened a summit in Berlin to divide up Africa and its resources. Everyone was invited, except for any Africans themselves. There were other barriers to plant collecting in Africa for Fairchild. East Africa had few harbors, and landing required an unreliable method of being lowered in a clothes basket into a small dinghy next to a ship, which was especially perilous in choppy seas. In Mozambique, Fairchild picked up a small, perfectly round fruit. It was a Kaffir orange, named for the pejorative term for black Africans who ate it. Only one orange made it back to the ship, where it hardened like a rock. Fairchild had to use a hatchet to break open its dried, solid skin. Inside was brown flesh with the taste of a ripe banana. Further south, Durban yielded the Carissa plum, deep red in color and with white leaves that resembled those of a tropical plumeria. Fairchild sent a case to Florida, believing the mix of foliage and fruit would prove an attractive combination. He was right. A chef in Cape Town delighted Fairchild with an outlandish fruit, a personal-sized pineapple, no bigger than a drinking glass, that he believed could change the world. "We tore the pineapples to pieces with our forks, and to our astonishment found scarcely any core. Also, they were far sweeter than any we had ever tasted, and had practically no fiber," he wrote. He saved the tops and sent them in. Wouldn't every American want a pint-sized pineapple all to themselves, the way they were used to eating a banana or an apple with no need to share? No, was the answer. Growers in Florida and Hawaii weren't interested in small. The people wanted big, even bigger pineapples than already grown, no matter the weight or the cost of shipping. So Fairchild's giddiness, the kind a grown man could find only from a personal-sized pineapple, was brashly extinguished. Alexander Graham Bell's home was located just south of DuPont Circle at 1331 Connecticut Avenue. One of the most elegant in Washington, it was a house befitting a man of Bell's prestige, a bespoke, three-story red brick mansion, angular and boxy, with a circular staircase, a grand parlor lined with fine oak and pregnant windows that swelled out toward the street on every floor, all in the precise taste of Bell and his wife, Mabel, for an immodest $31,000. Money flowed freely in the years after Bell demonstrated the telephone, which contributed to America's growing reputation as a land of opportunity for immigrants. The inventor had risen from tragic circumstances. Tuberculosis killed his two brothers, which spurred the family to move from the United Kingdom to Canada, and then to America. The move to North America opened the path for young Bell to soar higher than Great Britain would allow. The most remarkable thing about Bell wasn't his famous inventions, but that in 30 years he rose from frazzled immigrant to denizen of the highest level of America's intellectual elite. In a way, Bell was one of many. In the years around the turn of the century, men of science found Washington to be a city in renaissance, a place where casual conversations among a room full of men could yield dramatic expansions of government. One effect of Reconstruction after the Civil War had been the government's eagerness to rebuild, which it did by funding scientific associations. Around the same time men were inking the charter for the National Geographic Society, other scientific societies sprouted, including the American Biological Society, the American Chemical Society, the American Anthropological Association, and a society for entomology enthusiasts. By 1900, there were too few men to sustain the profusion of societies on whose rosters, one after another, often appeared the same names, leaving one to wonder if the few hundred men needed an excuse to escape their families 2, 3, even 4 nights a week. Each Wednesday evening at 7 o'clock, 20 men in 3-piece suits would gather in Bell's downstairs parlor, where they would mingle until their host escorted his aged father, Alexander Melville Bell, a man born in 1819, to a chair in the center of the room. Bell would make opening remarks, perhaps giving the evening a theme such as exploration or curiosity. Then he'd invite one man to speak about science or the arts. The senior Bell was unquestionably proud to see his son the nucleus of such cerebral energy. Melville had provided the inspiration for his son's inventiveness, even though Alexander's father-in-law provided the push. Gardiner Hubbard wouldn't permit his daughter, Mabel, to marry the scatterbrained inventor until Bell got serious about a single project. Only after Bell patented the telephone in 1876 did Hubbard allow the wedding to proceed. Bell, in his high-minded scheming, had a similar plan for Fairchild, whom he had only observed once and had never formally met. But Fairchild reminded Bell of his younger self, ambitious yet capricious, established but with much still to accomplish. Fairchild didn't know this. He sat in the corner hoping no one questioned whether he belonged. As he tried to follow the discussion, he became distracted by the titles on Bell's bookshelf. He later described the scene that delighted him. Mr. Bell was at his charming best on these occasions, for he enjoyed his guests, drawing them out with courteous and interesting questions. You were conscious of his dominant personality the moment he entered a room. His thick gray hair curled back from a high, sloping forehead, and he had a full beard and extraordinary eyes, large and dark, under heavy eyebrows. Mr. Bell was tall and handsome with an indefinable sense of largeness about him, and he so radiated vigor and kindliness that any pettiness of thought seemed to fade away beneath his keen gaze. He always made you feel that there was so much of interest in the universe, so many fascinating things to observe and to think about, that it was a criminal waste of time to indulge in gossip or trivial discussion. Bell loved the discourse, but the real purpose of the salon was to forge bonds between different disciplines, where overlap could yield new discoveries. A chemist meeting an entomologist, or an environmentalist brainstorming with an engineer. Fairchild's first Wednesday evening salon brought about two lasting relationships of his own. The first was with Alfred Cooley, the government's civil service commissioner, who had enviable status as a member of Theodore Roosevelt's tennis cabinet. The group, as Cooley explained to Fairchild, was informal, a friendly alternative to Roosevelt's stuffy panel of serious advisers. A profile of the tennis cabinet in the New York Times described the group thus. The president joked, they laughed. The president talked, they listened. The president played tennis, they lost. Cooley, whom the paper described as the strenuousest of the strenuous, and the four other members of the faux cabinet were so close to the president that they advised Roosevelt on matters ranging from statecraft to spelling, and were the influential force behind adding "In God We Trust" to American coins. It was through Cooley that, one day in April of 1903, Fairchild first came to meet Roosevelt. Little is recorded about their interaction except that the president, skilled at putting people at ease, congratulated Fairchild for the work he had done on America's behalf. Roosevelt made an offhanded suggestion that planted itself in Fairchild's mind, that a man of such worldly knowledge and experience could be useful if he stayed still for a while, and particularly in Washington. The second person Fairchild came to know at Bell's Salons was of a different sort. She was his age and fair-skinned, with long brown hair and slender fingers. Bell's plan lurched into motion. After several Wednesday evenings at the Bell Mansion, Fairchild received an invitation to Gilbert and Elsie Grosvenor's house for an intimate dinner. It was Bell's idea, and he asked his daughter to arrange it. When the places were assigned, Fairchild found himself next to Elsie's younger sister, Marion Bell, who, at 23 and with her hair in a bun, was worryingly unmarried. Marion was still young by any standard, but her family's high status drew attention to what might have been unremarkable in any other family. Marion knew about the setup on account of her loquacious sister, Elsie, but Fairchild did not. Elsie and Gilbert served dinner and then stayed quiet. Marion was fascinated by art the same way Fairchild was by science, and for 2 hours, Fairchild listened as she described her love of sculpture and her trips to New York. Fairchild imagined that a girl so articulate was certainly spoken for. But before the group disbanded for the evening, as if according to plan, Elsie Grosvenor worked into conversation that her sister was not yet engaged. An earlier Fairchild, obtuse and bird-brained, may not have picked up on such an unsubtle disclosure. But now he had a well-formed social awareness, an instinct he had honed over years talking with all kinds of people and in all kinds of situations. Elsie's aside was all it took. "I left the house, my mind in a whirl," Fairchild wrote of the evening. It's conceivable that Fairchild believed he'd never find himself coupled, that he'd begun his adult life a bachelor and would end it that way as well. He once carried on a cursory engagement with a woman in Maine to whom he was reasonably attracted, but not enough to curb his constant travels. His greatest influence had been Lathrop, who demonstrated in their years on steamships that life could be exceedingly well-lived without a wife. Fairchild's reaction to Marion, however, suggests that he simply hadn't met the right woman, one who could both challenge his instincts and put him at ease. And then, as if someone answered a prayer he hadn't prayed, here came someone as engrossing as she was radiant, who oozed poise and a charisma so pure it nearly drowned Fairchild's attention. "Concentration proved difficult," he wrote, describing his walk home. Plant introduction was no longer his sole object of affection.
Chapter 14. A Brain Awhirl. Fairchild toiled for days about how to talk to Marion. He wasn't so much intimidated by her well-regarded family as he was baffled by what to say. Among all the things Barbara Lathrop had taught him in their years circling the globe, how to speak suggestively to a woman hadn't come up. With his hairline beginning to recede, Fairchild considered himself not particularly handsome, an assessment Marion later confirmed. His intellect had caught her attention first. But he had already demonstrated his strong upbringing and heightened sense of manners, and perhaps most important for a man seeking the affections of a woman, that he could be interesting by being interested. He now lived at 1440 Massachusetts Avenue in another boarding house, this time squarely in the center of social Washington. It was one block from the National Geographic Meeting House, 6 blocks from the White House, and 4 blocks from the Bell's Mansion, where Marion lived with her parents. Even amid wisps of winter, it was an opportune distance to express his affections in hand-delivered letters. A week passed before Fairchild decided his first move. At the Grosvenor's dinner, Fairchild had mentioned that he had amassed a personal collection of Javanese batik cloths,
pieces of material with geometric designs made by molds of hot wax. Marion showed a hint of interest in the artistry she had only read about and never seen. So Fairchild sent over a small parcel of sarongs, which, in a breathless letter he rewrote twice, he clumsily offered to give to her as a loan, not quite a gift. "Miss Bell, the plain-colored sarongs are from Siam and seem of mixed silk and cotton, but the figured ones are from Java, the fairest of all Earth's islands, and they are Manchester cottons only. But how transformed they are by those soft browns and yellows from the tropical forests. Please keep these as long as you like. They are for your study. If you want Java, yes, I'll be delighted to get them for you. Isn't the weather gorgeous among the trees? With best regards, David Fairchild." Marion sent a cursory thank you note. After several more days, the best plan Fairchild could concoct was to invite her to visit his office. Fitting with the times, but perhaps not his intentions, he suggested she be accompanied by a chaperone. Courtship in the early 1900s proceeded at the pace of a groggy house cat, nimble in ways but overall slow and unsure. Only recently, in the waning years of the 1890s, had courting begun to change from a transaction to a pleasurable activity, an innovation so meaningful it took on a new term, dating. This was largely the effect of gender imbalance, which allowed a smaller pool of women to be selective among an abundance of men. Had Marion lived a decade prior, her parents might have matched her with a suitor based on their compatibility, a man to support a household and a woman to run it. But now, in 1904, a year when half the population of the United States was under 23, burgeoning couples wanted more, and women could afford to be choosy. It wasn't uncommon for a woman to feign illness, play hard to get, even end a relationship prematurely to test a man's true devotion. Physical attraction hadn't arrived as a top priority, but it still mattered. The Reverend Joseph Bush had written a manual on marriage and courtship circulated widely in the United States. "If in marrying you get nothing but a pretty face, you make a bad bargain," Bush wrote. "Beauty wears out, but breeding is in the bone, and in choosing a partner for life, regard should be had to what will last." His recipe for a lasting union was to seek someone with a refined soul, a large heart, and a noble mind. The opposite of all of these qualities should be avoided. On Thursday, January 5th, 1905, Marion visited the Department of Agriculture with her grandmother, Gertrude Mercer Hubbard, who at 77 retained an aura of pearled glamour even after having been widowed for 7 years. An awkward hour passed as Fairchild toured Marion and Mrs. Hubbard around the building, at one point taking them to the high-altitude attic that once housed the fledgling Office of Seed and Plant Introduction. One imagines him nervous and stiff, reduced to an insecure teenager, avoiding eye contact in the natural flow of conversation to kick himself mentally for the inanities exiting his mouth. The three stood in front of a planter box growing a woody climbing vine just beginning to show tender white flowers. He explained that it was from West Africa and a candidate for a new American garden shrub. He was, however, too modest to mention that just months prior, he himself had been on the coast of West Africa in Sierra Leone. Even if he had wanted to boast, he seemed to lack the capacity to know how. A few days later, Fairchild learned from mutual friends that Marion would be attending the Washington Charity Ball, hosted by the Washington Junior League, at the New Willard Hotel. Fairchild's age, just shy of 36, put him on the upper end of bows, but he decided to go anyway. When he tried to fill his dance card for the 20 waltzes and two steps, he found only 5 women willing. He danced with the first 4, one of whom was married, and then stood at the wall watching Marion be spun around the room by other men. When his turn came, the band played Strauss's Wiener Bonbons Waltz, the longest song of the night. The way Fairchild mixed up his steps made Marion laugh, and by the end of the song, he had worked up the courage to ask her to dinner. He wrote "supper" in his dance card next to Marion's name, as if he'd need a reminder to remember. Marion wasn't prone to falling in love. She had reached her mid-20s with only one young man making suggestive advances, which had annoyed her so deeply that her parents wondered if she was interested in men at all. The only man who had captivated Marian's attention was the sculptor, Gutzon Borglum, a New York artist who would one day be asked to carve the faces of four American presidents into a granite mountain in South Dakota. Borglum's studio was in New York, and after being granted an apprenticeship, Marian made regular trips north to see him. Marian had been drawn to the way Borglum's hands moved over the medium, be it rock or clay, and she particularly liked the moment the subject began to reveal itself. A nose, a face, a smirk. Marian watched him build busts of saints and apostles for the Cathedral of St. John the Divine near Central Park. In 1904, with her eyes wide, she watched him work on a sculpture of seven stampeding horses that would later end up in the Metropolitan Museum of Art. She delighted at Borglum's brilliance, the explosive way he was never satisfied. Once, he shattered a collection of finely sculpted angels when a critic off the street innocently suggested they looked feminine. Clearly, it was the right side of Marian's brain that lit up with creative amusement. This confused her family, no one more than her left-brained father, a man whose every action tested hypothesis after hypothesis via the scientific method. Even so, Marian thoroughly admired her inventive father, and he her. "I think she is going to develop into a self-reliant and beautiful woman," Bell wrote his mother in 1892, a few weeks after Marian turned 12. And she did, largely thanks to her mother's influence each summer in France or Italy, where Mabel Bell would bring her daughters to concerts, galleries, and museums. For all the credit granted Bell, the famous inventor had a deficit of affection for his daughters that in later years could be deemed overt sexism. Bell didn't hide his disappointment that having two daughters would leave no one to carry on the family name. The Bells had had two sons, but both died as newborns. He repeatedly skipped family vacations in Europe with Mabel and the girls to stay home and work on a new idea. In 1898, Clara Barton, the Civil War nurse who founded the Red Cross, invited 18-year-old Marian to accompany her to Cuba to treat soldiers fighting in the Spanish-American War. Her father thought it would only wound Marian and accomplish no good, so she didn't go. Her father didn't find out about the apprenticeship with Borglum until Marian had already accepted, which was the only reason she was permitted to do it. And to Marian, at 21, New York felt like the center of the world. The more she became engrossed with Borglum's work, the more she fell in love with the energy of the city. She attended concerts in the apartments of young musicians, often unchaperoned. She mingled with sculptors and architects in Greenwich Village. 20 years before the arrival of jazz, her parents worried about the raucous, liberal, and undisciplined influences of New York. Alexander and Mabel Bell wanted their daughter to find a husband as much for social appearances as because they hoped it would settle her down. David Fairchild seemed to be that calming influence, but he wasn't boring. He was a man of science, a traveler of terrific adventure, whose work was reasoned, methodical, and yet had an element of art, at least to the extent that the work he was doing, brightening the color palette of American agriculture, had never been done before. The letters kept arriving at Marian's house, delivered early in the morning during out-of-the-way detours Fairchild took by the Bell's house to the office. Marian would respond, enamored by the attention, but she was unwilling to equal Fairchild's more poetic, often unedited pronouncements. For their first official date, on January 13, 1905, Fairchild took Marian to the Washington Symphony Orchestra to see the Scottish pianist Eugen Dalbert. Fairchild took her hand as Dalbert played Beethoven and Tchaikovsky. And when they left, he tucked the program in his pocket to remember the occasion. He wrote her later that night. "That music was so deep and took such a hold that my brain is a whirl. You were very good to let me hear it, and I do like the intoxication of it, though it seems very showy and leaves one a bit weak. David." Marian enjoyed responding with tantalizingly little, but enough to invite more missives. "I like the way you write. It's very simple and direct. Marian." There was a lot Marian began to like about Fairchild, and eventually his demeanor became part of his charm. At a party hosted by the Grosvenors, Fairchild flailed his hands while he told a story. He knocked over a candle and spilled hot wax all over his coat, ruining it.
But Fairchild continued the story as though he had made the same faux pas dozens of times before. Marion would later note, in longhand, how she enjoyed his resilience in the face of setback, however minor. In February of 1905, a month that brought blankets of snow, they both took trips away from Washington. Marion left first for Detroit on art business. The collector Charles Lang Freer wanted to donate to the Smithsonian Institution a portion of his personal collection, and Marion, on account of her father's connections and because she had studied art, was asked by the Smithsonian to inspect the gift. Fairchild, not long after, took the train to Florida. He wrote to her from his Department of Agriculture office, and then once he departed, on any stationery he could find, at each stop feeling more comfortable with himself, more flirtatious, in the way an uncertain lover finds his footing. January 31st, 1905. Marion, did you ever look at a friend's photograph through a big microscope? I'm going to look at you through mine, my new one, for there is something real about the image that the delicate fashioned lenses cast. This letter shall reach you earlier than the others, for it will catch the last delivery. I hope it will find you in the sunshine, and not the shade. I send a leaf from a winter's day which I spent years ago in the Adriatic with a dear old Italian monk looking for a new sort of grape which is now growing in California. You will excuse this letterhead notepaper, will you not? It is some left from the last trip. Now come the letters, more of the artificial moonlight, and a tramp home in the snow. Good night, David Fairchild. Several days later, he wrote from Wilmington, North Carolina, on hotel letterhead. February 13th, 1905. There is no use in my trying to deceive myself. Each day seems to make your image more and more a part of my life. All day long the rain clouds and the twigs against the sky have been the only things of beauty worth watching, and in the beauties of these things, your presence has been so fully and so real that I cannot tell you of it. David. Fairchild wasn't eager to introduce Marion to Barbara Lathrop, who he feared could undo all of the delicate groundwork he had laid with a single remark, exposing Fairchild as churlish by association. In his letters to her and on their dates together, Fairchild had described Lathrop in terms more cutting than flattering. The nuance of his relationship with Lathrop, the man who both enriched and annoyed him, often simultaneously, was difficult to put into words. My friend, you know who, by 40 years of travel became like a naughty child among a host of presents, Fairchild had once told Marion. He wanted fresh personalities all the time, yet we traveled year in and year out through all sorts of lands, and when we last parted, our eyes were moist. Between us there was never nor could there ever be such a bond of sympathy, such similarity of tastes as have brought him and me together. Fairchild's warning aside, nothing could have truly prepared Marion to meet Lathrop for the first time. When he brought Marion to call on Lathrop in a Washington hotel room in the early days of 1905, the discussion started worse than expected. Uncle Barber, this is Marion. Lathrop studied her. Well, she has fine eyes. Then he turned to Fairchild. My God, Fairy, what has happened to your hair? It looks as though it hadn't been cut for months. You had better go right down to the barber shop and get a cut. You are a fright. Lathrop turned back to Marion, his voice raised. You think you can make him look like your father, do you? But your father has a great leonine head. He can wear his hair long. Fairy can't. Marion ran from the room crying, likely more embarrassed than actually stung. Fairchild followed her. In the hallway, Fairchild consoled her. Lathrop had criticized Fairchild hundreds of times about his hair, his clothing, his sluggishness, his lack of manners, his lack of respect, his shallowness of intellect, and any number of other things that entered his mind and left it just as quickly. Fairchild had become immune to it all. Yet when he was insulted in front of a new lady, his new lady, the critique cut deep. Why couldn't Lathrop understand the high stakes of this first impression, of being polite to someone important to Fairchild? Lathrop's petulant outbursts suggest he may have been bitter that Fairchild had found the companionship that had eluded Lathrop for so long. Or worse, that Lathrop lacked the self-awareness to know he had said anything wrong. Good Lord! What have I done? Lathrop said, when it became clear he had offended Marion.
It wasn't Lathrop who repaired the uncomfortable encounter, nor was it Fairchild. It was Marion. After she stopped crying in the hallway, she suggested that perhaps Lathrop was right, that Fairchild could use a haircut. Faced with an opportunity to stand up for himself, to demonstrate stiff resolution after a stinging insult, Fairchild chose differently. He knew that battles should only be fought when they have a reasonable chance of being won. So he obeyed. When he returned from the hotel barbershop, he found Marion and Lathrop giggling together over a story Lathrop was telling. A botched first impression granted a second chance. "There," Lathrop said to Marion, "you must admit that he looks better." Whether she thought so or not, she agreed. The climax of Fairchild's courtship with Marion came one day in February, just 3 months after they first met. Their dating had been steady and passionate, cresting with dozens of letters, sometimes many a day. Marion traveled north to New York for an art show. Fairchild, now so devoted he was prone to theatrics, followed her secretly. The plan wasn't only to casually bump into her in Grand Central Terminal. The plan was to take the same train back to Washington with her. Fairchild studied the timetables and memorized the path Marion would take to her train. The glimpse of a stunned Marion must have left Fairchild exceedingly self-satisfied. The plan worked. Marion gasped as Fairchild stood with a toothy grin and a bouquet of carnations. Somewhere between Trenton and Baltimore, David Fairchild asked Marion a question. And there, on a moving train, as it hurried south through the rain, he and Marion Bell agreed to spend their lives together. Instead of a ring, Fairchild gave her an engagement necklace made of Mexican gold and attached to an antique Roman coin with mystic characters. If the characters had a secret meaning, it remained secret between them. Their attraction for each other was a potent factor in their decision to wed, but what mattered more was the opinion of Alexander Graham Bell, whose sole authority could approve or deny his daughter's marriage. By now, the permission was largely a formality. Bell liked Fairchild. The setup had been his idea, and their engagement a logical extension. Yet still, Fairchild spent 3 days composing a lengthy letter to detail his pedigree. "My dear Dottie-san, for Marion says I may call you so," he started his long-winded essay. He described his family and upbringing, his lineage of university presidents, professors, and other academics. He said that his mother once told him that he might be related to Oliver Cromwell, Britain's first Lord Protector. He explained his full education and the path he had taken from Kansas to New Jersey to Washington, and then the association with Barbara Lathrop that opened his world to Java, Australia, and the islands of the South Pacific. He employed the names of scientists, both famous and obscure, with whom he had worked. Fairchild wasn't so much trying to impress Dr. Bell as he was penning a formal petition of his worthiness to join the esteemed Bell family. Unsurprising to everyone, Bell agreed to the marriage. He may have been uneasy about Fairchild's modest family, none of whom Bell had met on account of their being distant or dead. Yet he had always valued adventure, and here was his daughter in love with an adventurer scientist, a rare specimen in 1905, or any era. East Coast newspapers enjoyed the story of an artistic daughter of a famous inventor marrying a government scientist. Sensational reports spread the rumor that Marion's dowry could be as high as $1 million, an incredible fortune. The confidential reality was undoubtedly smaller, likely around $50,000, a sum still astronomical for a future son-in-law with less than $5,000 to his name. The engagement was short, only 8 weeks. And by pure luck, the period coincided with a new wave of exuberance in Washington for the arrival of Teddy Roosevelt's second term, which brought a gaiety of parties all over town. Fairchild found himself with 2 tickets to Roosevelt's inaugural ball at the Pension Building in the neighborhood that would eventually neighbor Chinatown. He was reluctant to fill his dance card with any name but Marion's. And when the dances stopped, the revelers gorged themselves on creamed oysters, French peas, chicken croquettes, and deviled ham. Dessert was the most memorable part of all, a tutti-frutti salad of candied raisins, cherries, and pineapple, a culinary safari of worldly fruits. On the day of their wedding, April 25, 1905, the procession of the extended Bell family to Twin Oaks, a white mansion on Woodley Road, was so hectic, Fairchild almost forgot to give Marion the corsage he had ordered specially with flowering cherry blossoms. The blooms were Marion's favorite flower from her favorite story of her fiancé's travels. He made himself a matching boutonniere. Before the ceremony, he gave her one last letter, which he had written late the night prior in the moonlight, kept awake by the timeless nerves of a man before his wedding. April 24th, 1905. My Marion, my own darling, let's not forget that like two leaves adrift together, we are in the stream of life, and let us hope no bars, no shallows, no eddies nor currents are to drive us apart, but we shall reach the open sea. Let's live, dear girl, and get from life what she holds in store for those like you and me, who've learned that all the world wants is a smile and a caress. It's now our wedding day. I love you with the fullness of a heart that's longed to love for years but has not found what now you've given. You're the sweetest, dearest girl of all. I love you. Yes, I love you. David. The wedding proceeded in the spring of Washington, forever its best season, between trees and surrounded by Marion's abundant family. The estate was known to be the most beautiful park in Washington, where Fairchild and Marion were only granted their nuptials because the property belonged to Marion's grandparents, Gardner and Gertrude Hubbard, who traded seasons between the estate and their DuPont Circle home, just 2 miles apart. Alexander Graham Bell, his beard blown lightly by the wind, walked his daughter down the aisle. Everyone noticed her white accordion chiffon dress with pompadour silk, her flowing veil, her bright smile. No one realized she had forgotten to wear the corsage of cherry blossoms she had been gifted, least of all Fairchild, who stood with a stupefied smile as his bride shuffled forward. They laughed after the ceremony about how she forgot the flowers, and then, figuring the story would make a nice souvenir, they plucked the flowers from Marion's corsage and from David's boutonniere, stuffed them into 2 envelopes and sealed them shut. The mementos from their wedding would be passed down through generations of their descendants, each a product of their marriage, until 100 years later, when the erosion of time would disintegrate the petals into dust. Chapter 15. Cherry Trees with No Cherries. Fairchild's first choice for a best man to stand beside him at his wedding was his closest boyhood friend, Walter Swingle. But Swingle was abroad, searching for something, somewhere. Barbara Lathrop, his globe-trotting companion, was difficult to pin down, and unable to attend the wedding. And so, with his dearest friends unavailable, he turned to Charles Marlett, the man who had the bare qualification of having grown up next to Fairchild in Kansas. Marlett had once been the strange neighbor boy obsessed with bugs. Now he was a fully credentialed entomologist devoted to the study of American insects. Many insects were immigrants to America the same way that Fairchild's fruits were, but Marlett saw a more ominous future for the country if it was negligent of what was crossing its borders. With his own eyes, Marlett had seen the damage insects could do. In the 1880s, he watched the San Jose scale, an ugly yellow insect, infest and suffocate fields in California. He took an expedition to Asia that was as desperate as it was fraught with danger to hunt for the scale's natural predator. When he found a candidate species to demolish the scale, he brought an entire colony back. The predators were red and black beetles, each so graceful and feminine they became known as ladybugs, also ladybirds. Marlets were the first ladybugs in America, which was a remarkable accomplishment considering that the full colony he tried to introduce had almost fully died en route, except for 2 of its inhabitants, Mr. and Mrs. Ladybug, newspapers called them, who, with only their kinetic energy, rebuilt the population and eliminated the pesky San Jose scale. If Marlett was born with any patience, watching this tense episode had consumed it all. Marlett liked Fairchild. He was 6 years older and tended to see Fairchild as a younger brother. They both had a deep love for science. In a way, Marlett was responsible for Fairchild's love of Java. In the 1870s, it had been Marlett who first alerted Fairchild that the famous Alfred Russel Wallace would be visiting their town. Fairchild informed his father, who then invited Wallace to stay in the Fairchild home for an evening, during which the biologist fascinated George Fairchild's son with vivid descriptions of the Malay Archipelago. But in Washington, a town more professional than personal, Marlett's feelings toward his childhood friend had grown as lukewarm as a tight-lipped smile. To Marlett, Fairchild enjoyed enormous privilege, first in his family connections that landed him his first job with the USDA, and then in his association with Barbara Lathrop, who financed his travels around the world. Marlett hadn't had it so easy. In Kansas, he served as an apprentice to a government